Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The Slate Culture Gabfest is brought to you by The Great Courses Plus, a new video service with more than 5,000 lectures. As a member, you can watch as many lectures as you want on any device. And for a limited time, listeners of The Culture Gabfest can watch one of the most popular courses, The Everyday Gourmet, Rediscovering the Lost Art of Cooking, for free. Just visit thegreatcoursesplus.com/culture. And by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price. Casper mattresses come with free delivery and returns within a 100-day period. And get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/culture and using the promo code CULTURE.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Beyonce Wins the Super Bowl edition. It's Wednesday, February 10th, 2016. On today's show, Hail Caesar is the 1,011th movie from the Coen brothers. It stars Josh Brolin as a studio boss in the 1950s, juggling ransom demands, gossip queens, and the hydrogen bomb. And then, speaking of dropping the big one, Beyonce has dropped, I hate that locution, a new single, a new video, on top of which she ate Coldplay like a wee little snack during the halftime show at the Super Bowl. We talk both the music and racial semiotics of Formation with Wesley Morris. And finally, Seth Stevenson. It's that time of year again. Seth Stevenson tells us which ads he loved and hated from the aforementioned Big Game. Speaking of hunting big game is Julia Turner, the head of Slate, the biggest game of all. Hey, Julia, how's it going?
Hi, Steve. I don't know if I am hunter or hunted in that metaphor, but it's very nice to have you back on the show. Hello.
I knew that you would bat it about the metaphor about like a spry cat no matter what. And I promise not to shoot you in the face. Dana is her full name, her given name. The birth certificate, if we believe it, reads Dana Stevens.
I'm like Beyonce. I just have one name, just the one.
And you're the film critic of Slate.com and my beloved colleague, Dana. How's it going?
Very well, thank you.
Julia, before we dive in, do we have any business?
Only to mention, well, two bits of business, I guess, actually. First, we should mention that in Slate Plus, Dana and I are going to grill you about how morally culpable you should feel personally for football, Steve, and sort of what it was like to watch the 50th Super Bowl ever, knowing what we now know about that sport and what its violence inflicts upon the men who play it. And also, we should mention that the Mom and Dad Are Fighting show, much touted, was rescheduled because of the blizzard, has been rescheduled to February 18th. That's a Thursday night at the Bell House in Brooklyn. If you got tickets to the original, they are transferable to this evening. If you did not, now you have a chance to go see Dan and Allison and their many special guests do what will no doubt be an awesome show. All right, that's the business. Let's commence.
Lovely. All right. Well, Hail Caesar is the Coen brothers' pay-in. How do you say that?
I think like that. Pay-in.
I try to avoid saying that word. It's got too many vowels in a row. I only write it.
I know. Well, even worse, my copy reads pay-in cum satire.
That was the best pay-in in eons.
Anyway, it is a pay-in cum satire about the heyday of the old Hollywood when everybody, even the biggest stars, were under contract within a vaguely totalitarian system known as the studio system. It follows a studio executive and fixer named Eddie Mannix, who struggles with his own Roman Catholic conscience and a host of bizarre problems, most prominently and most bizarre, the kidnapping of the star of his massive biblical epic, still under production, stolen off the lot by disgruntled communists, a.k.a. screenwriters. The kidnapped movie star is played by George Clooney to great effect. Why don't we listen to a clip?
Any more thoughts about who you might marry?
I ain't doing that again. I had two marriages. It just cost the studio a lot of money to bust them up.
Well, we had to have those annulled. One was to a minor mob figure.
Vince was not minor.
And Buddy Flynn was a band leader with a long history of narcotic use.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They were both louses. Marrying a third louse ain't gonna do me no good.
I've offered you some very suitable, clean young men.
Pretty boys, saps and swishes. What, you think if there wasn't a good, reliable man, I wouldn't have grabbed him?
What about Arne Seslem? He is the father, isn't he?
Yeah.
A marriage doesn't have to last forever, but Deanna, having a child without a father would present a public relations problem for the studio. The aquatic pictures do very nicely for us.
So you go and strap on a fish ass in Mariani Seslum.
The pictures do well for all of us, and it's a tribute to you. The public loves you because they know how innocent you are.
That's true.
Let me see if Arne is open to matrimony, yeah? You sure he's the father?
Yeah, absolutely he's the father, yes. Pretty sure.
We're laughing already. Dana, as I recall, you have some truly nuanced feelings about the Coen brothers and their body of work. How did you feel about this movie, and where do you think it fits in with what they've done previously?
Yeah, it's interesting. This movie occasioned, on film Twitter anyway, a huge drive to rank all the Coen brothers' movies in order and decide where this one fell and where all the others fall. And it made me think of the fact that, for me, the Coen brothers' movies, although I always look forward to each new one with enthusiasm, have the quality of collectibles in some way. They have this quality of these, like, these distinct units of kind of aesthetic production that you can file on a shelf. It's sort of, I didn't rank them, but it makes sense to rank them because they sort of ask for it in that way. That was a long way to get to saying I was really sad that I was on writing break when this movie opened because it seemed so fun to write on based on all the buzz and the trailers. And then having seen it, I was sort of relieved that I don't have to write on it because although it's barrels of fun to watch, I don't know that I would have a lot to say about it or that it's a movie with a whole lot to say for itself. I sort of feel like, strangely to say about the Coens, because they tend to be so dark and sardonic and biting, but I felt like this movie needed more dark, sardonic bite. I mean, I don't think it did near justice to how brutal the MGM, which I think this Capitol Studios, you know, that they've invented, incidentally, the same studio that existed in Barton Fink. It's their fictional Hollywood studio that they returned to. It's nowhere near as brutal as MGM actually was in this period under Eddie Mannix. And it seemed to me like this was kind of a softball pitch of a movie, although it's full of delights that we can talk about.
Yeah, I had a real feeling of squandered resources and squandered premise when I watched this movie.
Yeah, like, is that all there is feeling at the end, right?
Despite how many totally delightful moments there are in it, and I'm glad we listened to that clip of ScarJo the wisecracking, the tough mermaid. You know, every little particular star turn in it is delightful. And I think a new star is perhaps minted with the performance of Alden Ehrenreich, who's basically the only unknown with a major part. And in fact, the only unknown with even a minor part, like even these tiny bit players in the film get Oscar nominated stars like Jonah Hill playing them. Everybody gets a fun little turn and an accent and a bit. But the whole thing doesn't feel like it ever achieves liftoff. There's no sense of stakes. There's no sense of this being either a truly delightful, surprising caper. Everything's a little bit leisurely in its pacing. And there's no sense that any of it matters. And maybe that just feels like a naive, stupid thing to want from a Coen Brothers movie or something. Like, they're so cool and in on their own jokes. But I liked it fine and think it was a great night at the theater and think you should go see it. And yet, don't think it amounts to anything. What about you, Steve?
I think they raise the stakes by making the movie partially about communism and God and the Cold War. Like, these are these huge entities, kind of thematic entities that are all throughout the movie. They're not small or incidental or backdrops. I mean, it is a huge part of the movie that they're filming the story of Christ from the point of view of the Romans, and Clooney plays a Roman. How you're going to depict the Son of God on screen is a huge part of the movie. It's one of the funnier and better realized scenes in the film, is Brolin discussing this with religious leaders. You know, I won't give anything away, but there's a defection to the Soviets, the communists. I loved the scenes with the disgruntled communist screenwriters sitting around talking dialectics with Clooney, who's brought around almost immediately to the thesis that the little guy is getting inexorably screwed by the capitalist system because he's a puppy. He's sort of a Ronald Reagan-like puppy who wants to please the people that he's with. So he mixes his own almost instant conversion to Marxist dialectics in with, you know, stories about Danny Kaye shaving his back in Las Vegas. All of that's really beautifully done, but it doesn't, I agree, seem integrated to a point, right? That they're so smart at invoking these large themes about, well, what is it the American Empire does? I mean, the Romans conquered the entire world via violence. We conquer it via Hollywood movies. Like, these are all themes that they're totally aware of and, you know, putting into the stream of their own film. And then every particularity is charming. I mean, including Clooney, who's wonderful. Scarlett Johansson is great. Channing Tatum is luscious as always. And you want it to come together into a coherent emotional whole. And Dana Stevens, I'm going to say you're right on this one. It doesn't really.
Or a political whole either, to me.
But I loved it also. I mean, I was no part of me didn't delight in going to see it.
Yeah, I loved it. I just wanted it to be amazing. And instead, it was just fun. I mean, and there is this climactic moment at the end, which I don't think it spoils the film too much to say that Josh Brolin's character, who's named Eddie Mannix and is based on the real life MGM fixer named Eddie Mannix, who if you do go see this movie, you should listen to the Karina Longworth You Must Remember This series on MGM, which gives you the backstories of some of these types of dramas within the studio system, and which introduces you to the real life figures of Eddie Mannix and Nick Skank, who sort of end up as figures of sorts in this movie. But so Josh Brolin's character is wrestling with the fact that he wants to be in the movies and it feels right, although maybe there are other more grown-up things to do with his life than dealing with all these kooks and loonies. And then towards the end of the film, he gives a kind of triumphant speech about what it means to make movies and how important it is to make movies, and that the work that they do so ridiculously is valuable and worth believing in. And he... At once, the movie asks you to very deeply believe in his belief in that, and also kind of zooms out in a cold, sardonic Coen Brothers way to suggest that maybe he's wrong, even though it just feels right, which suggests that maybe they're thinking about their own devotion to the art of movies and how fundamentally insubstantial it is, and then that's why the movie feels insubstantial. But the thing that I did love about it, and that does sort of hold together thematically within it, is that the power of a true star being a star on screen is kind of a magical thing to watch. And it does provide this showcase. It's almost like a little jewelry box where you open a bunch of little boxes and you get to see a little gem-like performance from a true charismatic person who can hold your attention on screen. And it's a little bit of a like a demo reel. Like, look what we can do with movies. Like, you get to see ScarJo being a sassy vixen, and you get to see... the introduction of a young cowboy. And, you know, they talk a lot about one of the things that George Clooney's character, he plays Baird Whitlock, but one of the things that this star has to do in this Hail Caesar movie about Christ is see Christ's face and convey to us, the audience, how humbled and moved and converted he is by the experience of meeting Jesus Christ. And he kind of pulls it off. And so They've written a role where George Clooney, the star, has to play a star whose sheer star power can carry this plot. And they have all these stars, and they do starish things in a starish way that's delectable, but they just don't amount to anything except for a suggestion that the movies are powerful but useless. And so this movie sort of feels powerful but useless.
Dana, I have a question for you, and I'm really curious to hear your answer about this. Is it that they showed a degree of courage by not making the movie more sinister? And is that a way of saying, you know, we tend to look back on the 1950s and say beneath, I mean, the common way of looking back on the 1950s is to say that underneath the conformity and the sentimentality and the patriotism, there was, there was McCarthyism, there was, a degree of like violence, and they didn't make that movie, right? Was that courageous or was that pulling a punch? I kept trying to decide that as I was watching the movie, because I liked that Mannix was in a way a man who seemed to have a core of decency. It's not about him as a, you know, inherently vicious man or a philanderer. All these tropes they refused. Did you experience that as in its way quite original and courageous, or as a punch that got pulled?
I don't know. I mean, I guess I have trouble framing it as courageous exactly, especially because it seems like their moral imperative in recent movies has been just the opposite. They've been very interested in dark underbelly exposure and kind of elaborating how systems work to kind of oppress the individual, which is what the communist writers are giving voice to in that scene where they try to convert George Clooney. But the movie doesn't seem to believe them. It doesn't seem to believe anyone. I don't know it stands ideologically. I mean, it seems strange to me to raise the specter of all of these things, communism and the blacklist, which this movie, I think, is supposed to take place on the cusp of, right? I think the idea is that the McCarthy blacklist has not started yet, but that we're on the eve of it. But yet there's not really a feeling of menace to that plot about the communist sympathizing film writers. I mean, if you think about the fact that they've already made a Hollywood satire that was incredibly brutal and I think went pretty deep in terms of its critique of that system, which is Barton Fink. And they've made a movie about a crisis of faith, Serious Man, about a Jewish crisis of faith rather than the Catholic one that the Josh Brolin character is having. But that movie, A Serious Man, is also hard-hitting and serious with all of its farce and comedy. So it just seemed to me like this was an underachieving movie in some way. The last 20 minutes or so, I did start to feel this feeling of deflation, like these scenes are wonderful little gems to collect in a jewelry box. We didn't even mention Ralph Fiennes, fantastic as this kind of fey, ascot-wearing director named Lawrence Lawrence. And so the cowboy is always in confusion about whether to call him Lawrence, his first name, or Mr. Lawrence.
And he gets corrected either way. Yeah, no, it's,
there's
it's
a great kind of who's on first dialogue scene between them. I mean, the dialogue is as well written and funny as anything in any Coen Brothers movie. But to gesture toward things like McCarthyism and the Blacklist, you know, the actual violence and menacing nature of a fixer character like Eddie Mannix, the real Eddie Mannix, or even the Loretta Young story, which seems to be what was sort of filtered into the ScarJo bathing beauty story, right, about this pregnant starlet who is given the chance to have her own baby and then adopt it as if she had adopted it. I mean, that detail anyway comes from Loretta Young's story, which if you start to dig deeper into it, is a story of date rape by Clark Gable. And it's an awful, dark story. And I felt like all of that stuff that could have been at least hinted toward was almost repressed or buried away.
Yeah. I think, you know, we need to move on. But I mean, it did remind me in that regard of Preston Sturges' classic Sullivan's Travels, which invokes the grinding horrors of the Depression. And, you know, this one director's, I won't go into it. But I mean, it's a movie about how movies at the end of the day are incredibly hypocritical and corrupt, and they're made by hypocritical and corrupt people. But they're also completely redemptive. They play a completely redemptive role in modern life. So I thought, yeah.
But it ends on the Sullivan's Travels ends on this very populist, you know, arguably somewhat creepy, but very populist and humanist affirmation of the power of the movies. And I don't think the Coen brothers, I mean they may be showing their softer side, but they don't go that far.
They almost do, though. And then I won't give anything away. They come so close, and then their sardonicism.
Yeah,
I don't
they
know,
undercut the final scene where that could happen by, like, cutting away to these people who are moved and look ridiculous for being moved.
Or do they? I mean, that's why it's an interesting movie, and that's why you should go see it. It's called Hail Caesar. Our segment on it is now officially over. but I give it a thumbs up. Everything they do is so smart.
I'll see it just to watch Channing Tatum's dance number. I mean, crown jewel.
Yeah, and don't watch the trailers. This is the other thing I will say. Because all the moments are these little jewel moments that don't add up to anything, the trailers, I felt like I'd been over-promoted of the movie. And if you'd gone in not expecting anything, you would have been utterly delighted. So even though we all didn't like it, go see it and don't watch any trailers first.
Totally agree. And tell us, this is one of those ones where we really, really want to hear deciding votes on this. Come to facebook.com/culturefest. Tell us what you thought of Hail Caesar. All right. Well, now is the moment in our podcast where we talk about our sponsor, Julia Turner. What do we have?
Our sponsor this week is The Great Courses. I think, like many of you listeners, you probably listen to this show because you like to learn things, or at least hear people learning things. And that's why we're excited about the new Great Courses Plus video learning service. It offers unlimited access to a huge library of the Great Courses lecture series in so many fascinating subjects. And they're giving our listeners an incredible opportunity right now. You can watch one of their most popular courses, The Everyday Gourmet, Rediscovering the Lost Art of Cooking, for absolutely free. They developed the course in partnership with the Culinary Institute of America, America's greatest cooking school that also shares a name with the CIA. I love that fact about the CIA, the other CIA, the food CIA. But without having to join either CIA, you can experience many of the culinary tips that you would get there from the comfort of your own kitchen via video. It's a great way to learn from a master chef. For a limited time, The Great Courses Plus is offering our listeners a chance to stream this course, The Everyday Gourmet, which is a $235 value, and hundreds of other courses for free. But this free offer is only available for a limited time, so hurry. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/culture. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/culture. All right, Steve, what's next?
Thanks, Julia. Okay, moving on. Beyonce has once again blowed up the internet, this time with the video for her new song, Formation. It is, in fact, mind-blowing, but I'm a white guy with an easily blown mind, so let me quote a woman of color. Sarita McFadden, writing for The Guardian, said,
Formation is both provocation and pleasure, inherently political, and a deeply personal look at the black and queer bodies who have most often borne the brunt of our politics. I should add that on the con side, such as Rudy Giuliani have weighed in against, but we've invited Wesley Morris, the critic at large for The New York Times, to come in and discuss with us. Wesley, welcome to the show.
Hey, y'all. Stephen, what did you say? What was your diction on that? Blowed up? Did you say blowed up?
I think it's
I was thinking about the old SCTV skit.
Because this is about to get real up in here if it blowed up.
It blowed up. It totally blowed up the internet. I just assume that every third syllable, I'm going to misspeak on this subject.
No. See, we cannot have that. I don't want to have a conversation in which you recuse yourself because you're white. I don't accept it.
Wesley, I've spent a lifetime recusing myself because I'm white. Let's not stop now.
I didn't do it.
This is on no one but me and John Calvin. Okay, so...
Calvin's a whole other thing that we should probably do a segment about at some point.
All right, well, we should listen to a clip of the song, but I will say, regardless of who gets to talk about this song or whatever arguments about that we do or don't want to have... It does feel crazy to play the song as a piece of music because the song is the video. Like the song, like I feel like we should turn this into a visual podcast. You could all just watch. In fact, you should just go watch the video Formation and then come back and listen to the conversation about it. Or don't, just go play it on repeat 35 times, which is what I did this weekend. But we will play a clip of the chorus of the song to give us an audio cue.
My daddy Alabama, mama Louisiana. You mix that Negro with that Creole, make a Texas Bama. I like my baby hair with baby hair and afro. I like my Negro nose with Jackson 5 nostrils. I earned all this money, but they never take the country out me. I got hot sauce in my bag. Swag.
Ooh, yeah, baby.
But as Julie says, it's kind of all about the visuals in this video. So maybe we should describe some of what you see in Formation, which is largely, you know, a lot of different formations. I mean, it seems like this song is about a collective, right? About collectivity in some way. And the main formation that you see is Beyoncé and her girls, right? Dancing in formation. But there's also see a line of a policeman. What are the other formations? Like everything seems to be about mass gatherings.
It is a sort of witchy Beyoncé standing on the stoop of a home. Surrounded by her men. She's in black. Of course, she gives the finger. There's Beyoncé atop a New Orleans police cruiser.
That's slowly sinking underwater.
Submerged in Katrina-esque floodwater. There's, you know, the women dancing in the pool, Beyoncé and the Gucci-clad women dancing in a pool. An empty pool.
Is that where they are? I thought it was just like a dark gym.
It's a pool.
Okay.
It feels like it's a pool. And it's dark, so, and the pool could be in a gym, so you don't have to write a correction on that, which is my life now. Do you have to write a correction?
You don't have to watch it a 36th sixth time.
And then there's the stuff in the house I find the most evocative things involving Beyoncé directly. The shots of them sitting sort of gothic style on a divan. The dance they do in the hallway.
And then there's the parking lot. There's Beyoncé in a sort of acid wash jean jacket.
There's two parking lot sequences, right? There's the one, there's the washed out video one. See, this is parenthetically one of the problems I have with this video. I felt like there might be too much formation. I probably could have used two of them because they don't really, you get a lot of vibe, you get a lot of atmosphere, but you don't get a lot of it, whatever, like there are a lot of darts and they're all over the board, and some of them are kind of near a bullseye and a lot of them are like not getting you any points.
You mean in terms of like the referencing that's going on?
Well,
like here's a Ferguson reference, here's a Katrina reference, that it becomes too, the net is cast wide.
It's clearly a polemic. It is also clearly a bunch of other things involving Beyoncé's self. I think there's a kind of defensiveness here on her part in terms of her stating once again her authenticity, which I can imagine this. I mean, I get it. You become very famous and you are accustomed, you know, you grew up not terribly rich in the South and now you're a globally mega famous person and you don't want to get too far from your roots. And so you have to sort of reclaim your roots from people who might want to take them from you. I mean, she's sort of been about this sort of high glamour, low country conflation for several years now. And that's been sort of that's one of the things that I find compelling about her. But I also think as a visual artist, which she not primarily is, but I think very much secondarily is, I just, this video is not one of her best in terms of coherence.
Oh, wow. I found the video to be like a total bullseye and I loved it. And I think there are threads in it that feel like they're working at cross purposes to each other in ways that make it, you know, of all of the formations that she makes, maybe it's not entirely the arrow formation all pointing to one exact message. But I just felt like it was really powerful to see a pop star like Beyoncé, someone whose art has primarily been about love and her relationship and family and her relationship to beauty and her relationship to love and her relationship to her family and a little bit of the fame. But like, it's been pretty inward, a lot of it, to have her produce a single and video that are explicitly about the year of Black Lives Matter and connecting her own experience from her birth to her current mega success in the context of being Black seemed powerful to me. And it seemed like it was executed with her usual Beyoncé, Tracy Flick, A student, like perfection of execution. Like the whole notion of dropping a brand new song 24 hours before the Super Bowl and having the confidence that the video for it and the song itself would be so good that enough of the country would be excited about it and have watched it 36 times in that first 24 hours so that she could play a new song at a Super Bowl halftime show and have people be excited about it instead of what the hell. Like to debut a song at the Super Bowl halftime show is incredibly dumb, right? Like you're supposed to play songs. You're supposed to play like Tom Petty's greatest hits. You're supposed to play songs that the entire country can sing along to because they've known them for two decades.
Even if you're not Tom Petty.
Yeah. Yeah, no, like basically everybody should just get up there and play American Girl every year, kind of. I mean, not entirely, but...
Well, I mean, that is Giuliani's argument basically against the song. I mean, which is a whole other thing.
Right. Well, and Tom Petty's a bad example because he's an old white guy. But like, you know, when Beyoncé nailed it at the halftime show 2-3 years ago, whenever that was,
yep.
She played the Beyoncé canon. She played Beyoncé's version of American Girl, but she kind of spun through Crazy in Love and all of the hits she's made in the last 15 years that everybody knows by heart. You know, the Audie's version of American Girl basically is Crazy in Love, right? So the confidence of execution here, if I'm going to release a new song, I'm confident it's going to be a sensation. Then I'm going to perform it at the Super Bowl. Everyone's going to be excited instead of annoyed, agree that I've pulverized my buddy Chris Martin and Coldplay to smithereens. And then I'm going to have the ad spot right after the halftime show where I'm like, I'm doing a tour, guys. Everybody come out. Like, it's this incredible, simultaneously politically powerful thing that is a classically Beyoncé, a student perfect bit of bravado and self-promotion. And the whole thing is both classic Beyoncé and felt like a very new Beyoncé to me because despite all of that, despite the marketing of it, it did not feel craven and cynical to me.
Oh, like, no, it's the opposite of craven.
Well, you could see that point, right? Like
I'm gonna
do a Black Lives Matter song and then everyone will talk about me and then I'll sell tickets to my tour. Like there's a way to look at that given her history and career that would be cynical, but it reads as like really personal and really strong to me.
And I don't disagree with any of that. I am, by the way, I would say in the five stages of Beyoncé, I'm probably at acceptance now. I mean, Saturday it was euphoria. I'm not going to do the classic Kubler-Ross breakdown. But I mean, you go through these stages with this sort of thing, at least when you're responsible for like having to think about it and then also having to consume it happily. I did sort of think that, you know, there's a kind of brazenness to her that I appreciate. Her sense of effrontery is very high. And I think that she understands the place that she has in the cultural landscape. And it's very strong at this point. She is news. I mean, everybody stopped what they were doing if you were a culture journalist and you had to deal with this. Like it was the opposite of a death, obviously, but it was covered like a meteor had just hit the planet because in fact it had.
Right.
I mean, Julia, I basically come out where you come out let me add this that, you know, there is this question of can anything human happen during the 4.5 or 5 hour ritual that is the Super Bowl. I mean, there is this kind of North Korean vibe now to all of the live performances at the halftime.
I was thinking about the opening ceremonies that Russia did.
Yeah, it's not that far off, right? It's like Free Enterprise's equivalent of totalitarian public, you know, carnival, you know, and I don't know how to shake that out, right? So in the midst of it, someone makes, you know, a pretty nakedly potent statement about the relationship between white and black America. It both partakes of the meganess and impersonality of everything else around it. It just inexorably, it just has to do that. At the same time, it's like, you know, especially in the middle of a game, Wesley, that was kind of presented as the conflict between an aging white quote unquote all-American quarterback and like a young, super athletic, but perhaps too, you know, self-celebrating, you know, black quarterback.
A flashy buck, basically. Like, that's the subtext to the Cam Newton, Peyton Manning.
The text, right? I mean, it wasn't even the subtext. I couldn't even get it beneath the text. Everyone was trying
Everybody's trying to shove it under the text, right?
But that was the public theater of the Super Bowl this year. That was the storyline. And so in that sense, you know, and also, you know, you're only going to fight Mega with Mega. And this is where she's willing to stake a part of her brand. And I thought that that was really important. One other comment I had, and I'm very curious to know, Dana, what you think of this, is that are you amazed at the degree to which the internet is now taken for granted on the production side of culture? That you can produce something as information dense as this video that obviously, first of all, requires the internet sort of on-demand repeated viewing just to kind of assimilate it all in, but also presumes this army of semioticians out there, both amateur and otherwise, waiting to receive it, break it down, comment on it, comment on the commentary on it. You know, everyone from, you know, tenured queer studies professors to, you know, some intern at Jezebel is going to have an opinion about it. And it you would only build something that looked like this because you knew that this army was out there waiting for it.
Right. I mean, in the final couplet of the song, which I've been like trying to understand, and which is the part that keeps nagging at me. And let's actually just play the final two lines of the song, which I think are worth talking about.
You know you that bitch when you cause all this conversation. Always stay gracious. Best revenge is your paper.
And to me, this is the part that makes you wonder what she's exactly trying to say here, right? Because she is reckoning with a broader black experience, but also with herself. She has definitely caused all this conversation. We are having this conversation right now. And the thing I can't figure out is the valence on the final line. Always stay gracious. Best revenge is your paper. Like, when I first watched the video for the first 14 to 16 times, I was like, wait, did she just short circuit this whole thing and be like, well, work hard, be nice, get rich, and that's how you prevail? But maybe now I've just watched it too many times. Now I feel like I'm reading this irony in her delivery of the line that complicates my viewing of the whole song.
Yeah, that is a strange positioning. I mean, once again, I don't know. I guess it seems to me like, although the visuals are so powerful, the message of this song and video seem sort of muddled to me. I mean, maybe it's just that those hip-hop tropes of, like, glamour and make the money and, like, shove it in their face and, you know, whatever, nothing succeeds like success, seem to grind so awkwardly against the political imagery that she's tapping into.
I think that the way that hit me, though, was in the greater context of what is actually, like, just electrifyingly polemical about this song, which is it's not just the paper. It's not just, like, cash. It's like a deed. It's like property.
Like ownership.
And, like, it's your paper. You own yourself. And in the new context of New Orleans and the South and, like, black home ownership. And, I mean, I don't know what she was thinking. I'm just telling you why that struck me so profoundly.
Yeah.
Which is that I just think she is talking about what it means to hopefully have something that belongs to you that hopefully once you have it can't be taken away. The irony, of course, is that in New Orleans, something like Katrina happens and you could lose everything. And it's a very complicated thing, like black ownership of anything, your body, your house. And I this song is very conscious, and the video, too, is very conscious of that. And that's a very strong thing to say. I don't think it's just like be successful in the way that I'm successful. It's like, ladies, own your shit. Own all of it. because if you don't, somebody else will, and you won't be happy. And so she really is in dialogue with an aspect of history that very few other women, and I don't like constantly mentioning her and Nina Simone in the same paragraph, but there is a degree to which this is not dissimilar. Nina Simone was obviously much more radical, much more revolutionary, but we have to remember also, Beyoncé's 34, this is the first song from an album we haven't even heard yet.
Yeah.
And given the way singles are working now, like what Rihanna did last week, by the way, remember Rihanna?
Oh, I know.
Remember her?
Poor Rihanna. Sad, shadowy Rihanna.
The way singles work now, this could not be on the album.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? So I just feel like this is like the opening salvo in what will probably be a much larger thing to think about.
All right. Well, this is an ongoing discussion, obviously. Wesley, it was great to have you join us for it. The video's Formation. Obviously, you can find it pretty much anywhere on the web. But listeners, please come to our Facebook page if you so choose and tell us what you thought of it. Facebook.com/culturefest. Wesley Morris is the critic at large for The New York Times. Wesley, just a great pleasure to have you back on the show.
Nice to talk to you guys.
All right. Now is the moment in our podcast where we talk about our other sponsor, Julia Turner. What do you got?
The Slate Culture Gabfest is sponsored today by Casper. Casper is an online retailer of premium mattresses. The mattress industry has long forced consumers into paying notoriously high markups. Casper is revolutionizing that industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing those savings directly on to the consumers. Can I just say, I love that the mattress industry is getting disrupted. Like, of all of the disruptive businesses that are out there disrupting things, some things, perfectly nice things that Steve probably thinks shouldn't be disrupted, I think we can all agree.
It's time to take on Big Mattress.
Big Mattress is like one of the worst things because and it sheerly takes advantage of the fact that the physical size, that is just a pain to get a mattress in and out of your house, and the sheer like physical size of it and the pain in the assness of it just has left consumers totally beholden to Big Mattress for so many years, because you go, you flop down, you're like, okay, the experience of lying successively on 10 different mattresses in this showroom replicates sleep in no way. Like, you're like, is this what I sleep like? Is this what comfort is? Is that, like, is my shoulder comfortable right now? Like, it's impossible to tell if you actually like sleeping on a mattress from a 10-minute whirl in a showroom. And so you have to buy this thing. You're not sure if you're going to like it. And then they charge you whatever the hell they want for it. And once you get it into your house, if you decide you don't like it, it seems really difficult to deal with it because it's huge, it's expensive, you probably can't move it by yourself. And Casper is proposing to solve all of these problems with its service. A Casper mattress provides resilience and long-lasting supportive comfort. It's a hybrid that combines premium latex foam with memory foam. They cost $500 for a twin size mattress and $950 for king. Comparing that to industry averages, that's an outstanding price point. And the whole thing is risk-free. They offer free delivery and returns within a 100-day period, so you can sleep on it for 3 months and figure out what shoulder comfort actually is to you and whether the mattress delivers it. And it's that simple. Plus, Casper's mattresses are made in America. Get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/culture and using the promo code culture. I love that our promo code is culture. Like all those other whack podcasts out there that might send you to Casper with their rival promo codes, do you get to claim yourself as a cultured person as you buy your mattress? You do not. Use our promo code, casper.com/culture. All right, Steve, what's next?
Thanks, Julia. Okay, moving on. It is that time of year again. We're joined by national treasure Seth Stevenson to talk about Super Bowl ads. Seth, I think you may be a national treasure the other 364 days of the year, but definitely one day a year you are national treasure Seth Stevenson. You are the guy to talk about what transpires during the orgy of free enterprise known as the Super Bowl. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'll take treasure to him any day of the year.
We don't get to passive-aggressively jibe each other about the Patriots this year, so we'll have to find other...
You can still do it. I'm sure I can slip it in somewhere.
All right. Well, let me... I know what the question on everybody's mind today is, were we supposed to eat the dachshunds?
I thought I wondered that too. You know, I didn't even mention that ad in my roundup because that was a lot of people noted that, in fact, the dachshunds were between buns racing towards the condiments. And the idea was we're going to like put relish on the dog and then eat it. And that's an uncomfortable thought. But I think most people can maintain that like the duality in their minds that the dachshunds are these cute things that somehow represent Heinz, but also they represent the hot dog. I think most people can handle.
Well, I also think maybe the world.
I was turned into my intellectual failure at this.
But wait a minute. The condiments are catching the dogs, correct? So the implication can't be that the personified condiments are then going to eat the dogs.
Mustard, it's
there
weird.
Has to be an imagined third party that is going to consume both.
Think about you're eating, when you put that relish on, you're putting human, it's like the intestines of that human are the relish, if you think about it. I mean, that's no better than eating the dog.
But wait a second. You act as though these things aren't, you know, scientifically designed by Pavlov himself to make you think about how delicious it is to, you know, put this particular condiment on a hot dog. I mean, it is stimulating you to think appetitively and about food. It just seemed bizarre to me to introduce into that these cute living dogs.
It definitely was not the most bizarre ad, but I did agree that it was bizarre because if you really get yourself fully ensconced in the metaphor, what you're thinking is like, wow, it's so wonderful how much the condiments love the hot dogs that they get slathered upon. That joyous union will be murdered by me and my teeth. Like, I will destroy all that love. But I do like a hot dog with Heinz ketchup, so.
If there's anything I've learned in my long period spent writing about advertising, is that you overestimate how much the thought was these puppies are going to be really cute. People are going to love the ad because they're cute puppies. And people will understand, you know, that we're not meant to consume the puppies.
I find it like understanding has nothing to do with how advertising is supposed to work on the human consciousness. But let's move on. Stipulated, you're not supposed to eat dachshunds. What was your? Let's go. Most favorite and least favorite ad this year.
Well, I'll say that in terms of effectiveness, the ad that I was most impressed with was the one that I thought actually belonged here, which a lot of Super Bowl ads are like, why did they do that? That seems an odd choice. They're not reaching the people they want to reach. It's a lot of money wasted. But there was this laundry detergent, Persil, which is distributed by Unilever in the U.S. It's a German laundry detergent. They've only been in the U.S. since March of 2015. So not a lot of people have heard of them. Now, laundry detergent is something that people of all ages buy, people both genders buy. So it's like a product that hits all the demographics. It's available in Walmart, so it's not like they're advertising and then people can't find the product. And so I thought that was actually a very useful use of your $5 million for 30 seconds to introduce this broad-based product to a huge audience all at once. So I thought that was actually effective advertising.
A leading consumer testing publication recently tested the top laundry detergents.
The winner, Persil 2-in-1, didn't only beat Tide.
It beat every single detergent tested.
Boom.
I love that that's your favorite ad. That is the ad that is literally like a man in a white tuxedo standing between two washing machines being like, hey, an important consumer brand said our detergent was best.
You wanted me to say puppy monkey baby. When you write advertising for so long, the flash disappears. The dachshunds, you know, fly by the wayside and you're interested in like who actually made the proper marketing decision. I thought Persil made the best marketing decision of the evening. Actually, the other best marketing move of the entire evening was Peyton Manning post-game repeatedly mentioning Budweiser.
Oh, just repulsive.
I got a couple of priorities first. I want to go kiss my wife and my kids. I want to go, you know, hug my family. I'm going to drink a lot of Budweiser tonight, Tracy. I promise you that.
And kissing Papa John, smooching Papa John.
Can we explain the Papa John thing? Scrum. I like decided not to figure this out. Papa John is who represents what, and was he paid to do that?
Papa John is a pizza-preneur. I don't know what you call him. You've never heard of Papa John?
No, I know Papa John's pizza is a chain.
He is Papa John.
But there's like a man.
John.
John. Who owns Papa John.
Presumably a father of some kind.
He's the father of the pizza chain. And Peyton Manning has been a longtime endorser of Papa John Pizza.
I see.
But also, Peyton Manning owns something like 21 Papa John franchises in Colorado and has, you know, spoken on the record about how Colorado legalizing marijuana has, you know, improved the pizza business in Colorado and what a boon it's been to him. And then he smooched Papa John postgame. He not only did that, but he also mentioned Budweiser completely unprovoked in his postgame interview immediately after the game, where people used to mention Disneyland. And Budweiser said, oh, no, we didn't give him any money to do that. We're appreciative that he did that. How nice of him to mention Budweiser for no reason. However, it turns out, in fact, he has an ownership stake in a couple of AB InBev distributors in Louisiana, and thus he does benefit from mentioning Budweiser. So that was another, I felt, very canny marketing move.
Wow, marketer of the game is Peyton.
Well, all-time NFL marketer.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that might, in my opinion, that might have been an FTC violation, the fact that he mentioned Budweiser in that context like that. But, you know, that just goes, it's just a slew of things that make Peyton Manning horrible, that the fact that he allegedly had HGH delivered to his home.
Oh, there we
his
go.
Name.
I knew we'd get there.
You knew it was coming, Steve. You knew it.
All right, but you haven't said the worst.
The worst. So last year was very notable thematically. If you remember, it was very somber, which was sort of the famously somber ad from last year was the dead child for Nationwide Insurance, the little boy who says, "I'll never grow up because I died in an accident." You see, like, it was just the saddest. And then there were all the absent dads, like the teary-eyed fathers last year. I think there was such a reaction to that last year. Or maybe that's something about this year's the nature of this year's economy or something. But the ads were really pulled in. They were much tamer. No, you know, it was just back to the old tried and true animals, you know, celebrities. So it was a pretty boring set of ads. One thing I noted was a lot of the ads were really small bore in what they were advertising. So it was a lot of like tiny product attributes. So the Honda Ridgeline ad was about, "We now have speakers in the truck bed," which is like a pretty specific product attribute. Or the Hyundai ad was like, "Now you can remotely start your Hyundai." You know, the Amazon ad wasn't a big brand ad. And this is the first ever Amazon Super Bowl ad. And it wasn't a big brand ad about how wonderful Amazon is. You can buy everything there. And it's this incredible brand. It was just about the Amazon Echo, which is their music playing personal assistant speech recognition device. It was just about one little product. Even like the Coca-Cola, which you can usually rely on to have a gigantic epic ad. This year, the ad was about mini Cokes, was about like a weird little product offshoot, their small can Cokes. So everything just seemed shrunk down. And I don't know if that's something about the tenor of our times. I don't know if that's the nature of advertising today, where they're sort of spreading themselves thinner and they're trying to reach people on Snapchat and Twitter. And so they're, you know, it's less useful to put all your chips in on this big Super Bowl ad. I don't know what it is, but I felt that everything was just a little bit smaller.
Yeah, it felt that way to me, too. And it felt also like one thing we've seen in the past couple years is like intense pre-release hype. Like people recognize that when you release all the ads at once, maybe yours isn't going to cut through the clutter. So people would release their ads early and try to start a conversation going before the Super Bowl. And maybe this year, just because we're dealing with the start of the election proper and the Iowa caucuses and the blizzard, like there just was less room for those ads to gain purchase. But there wasn't a ton of conversation around the ads before the game. You know, and then the ads themselves all seemed a little inert.
They're becoming less of a big deal.
What was the product that was being advertised by the Super Bowl babies with the people from all different generations singing about being Super Bowl babies?
The NFL itself.
Of course.
Yes, and Dale, as I noted in my roundup, there were no Patriots babies pictured in that ad. Clearly Roger Goodell had a hand in that decision.
I will say about the NFL ad, it was charming and Patriots oversights aside, kind of cute. But I found if the point of the messaging was football is on the precipice, it's ruining the brains and lives of the men who play it, it has a real violence problem and a violence against women problem, like the many of the men who play the sport have their transgressions against women swept under the rug by their teams because they'd like them to keep playing the game. Like if, and this was sort of NFL is family, right, was the tagline at the end of the ad. So the conceit of the ad was that all of these choirs were composed of people who were conceived on Super Bowl night by fans of the winning team. So like your team wins, you go, you have sex with your partner, boom, there's a baby.
I need you to spell it out for me, Julia. Wait, slow it down for me. So your team wins.
Well, Steve, when a man loves a woman.
But, and has had 8.5 Budweisers.
But so if part of the point here is to say, like, we're a family sport. This isn't just a place where, like, men go to be away from the fold. I'm not sure that harping on, like, presumably unplanned or relatively unplanned pregnancies is, like, the message that you send. To be like, this is how responsible humans build families. I mean, I'm not saying that any of these children were unwanted or unloved or that this ad wasn't cute, but, like, I was like, come on, NFL. Like, the notion of having a baby at an unexpected moment because you got too drunk watching the Super Bowl isn't, like, an unmitigated good in the world.
Right. And also, by the way, it's one of those, it raises the specter of its opposite, which is that in the losing cities,
there are women getting the crap beat out of them. I mean, let's just come out and freaking say
it. I hadn't thought of that,
no, but no, if people know, but people, if people on Twitter did immediately say, and in the losing cities, what are all those, you know, I mean, I just, I, if it weren't true, I wouldn't feel sort of somewhat obliged to say it. I mean, if you've been thinking through the issues, which we'll get to in the plus segment about what happens, you know, when you get football bloodlust up, you know, it just plays, it plays so many different ways. They just didn't, they didn't liberate themselves from their own worst demons by putting this ad on, not at all.
I will, I think those are completely fair criticisms, and I, but I will note on the other side of the progressiveness ledger, there was absolutely no cheesecake in any of the ads.
I was amazed.
None, and I think we wouldn't have to go very far back, maybe only a couple years, to where you know, really hot ladies in skimpy clothes would have been a feature of a lot of the ads, and sometimes played for laughs, sometimes played simply for hotness. But that was a very
Hottest woman was Helen Mirren, who's very hot, but is like not a classic Budweiser babe.
But that was like the
and
Budweiser
babe. And not to
mention, what Helen Mirren is doing is castigating the viewer for their potential overindulgence in the very product she's selling, right? I actually, I love that Helen Mirren spot. I mean, as guiltifying PSAs go, that was a funny one.
Oh, my beer, lovely. Hello, I'm Helen Mirren, a notoriously frank and uncensored British lady. The collective, we are dumbfounded that people still drive drunk. So I'll sum it up like this. If you drive drunk, you, simply put, are a short-sighted, utterly useless, oxygen-wasting human form of pollution, a Darwin Award-deserving, selfish coward.
That was a great one. And it wasn't one of those, you know, usually drunk driving ads. It's like flashing police lights, and here you are, you know, getting your mugshot taken. This was Helen Mirren calling you a pillock.
Like, that's the worst possible outcome. The scorn of Mirren. I mean, who wouldn't stay sober to avoid that?
Yeah, and the other, you know, the other, but the Bud Light ad. Bud Light used to have bikini babes all the time. And this year, Bud Light, it's Amy Schumer front and center for Bud Light, you know, in a very, in a dress and pearls. And she's, you know, one of the frat guys. She's drinking Bud Light. She's not a sexual object. She's a powerful lady running the Bud Light party.
That's why we're forming the Bud Light party.
Just wait till you see our caucus.
We got the biggest caucus in the country.
Woo-wee! But it's not like too big. Like, you can handle it.
You know, the other, so the other sort of slightly weird, so the puppy monkey baby. Well, let's briefly talk about the puppy monkey baby, because that was one of the most disturbing images, the most disquieting images of the entire night, was Mountain Dew's puppy monkey baby. The three elements, puppy, monkey, and baby, coming together in the way that dew, juice, and caffeine come together to make Mountain Dew kickstart. An unholy trinity.
Puppy, monkey, baby. Puppy monkey 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 baby.
Mountain Dew Kickstart. Dew, juice, caffeine.
Puppy monkey baby.
I mean, I understand why it caught a lot of attention, but I, what a weird, what an odd, I guess they, I think trying to reach the Mountain Dew Kickstart consumer, who I presume is a younger man or a teen or tween man, I can see why the Puppy Monkey Baby would be the kind of disruptive thing that would cut through the cultural clutter that assaults younger men. But what, how did you guys feel about the Puppy Monkey Baby? And how did you feel specifically about the fact that it was head of the puppy, torso of the monkey, lower half, including genitalia of the baby?
I loved you pointing that out in your ad roundup. It's true. Once you start to imagine that it's only the nether regions of this creature that partake in the Homo sapiens genetic pool, it just, it all becomes
Can
very
it reproduce,
unsettling.
Or is it the sterile beast?
Definitely sterile, I hope. I also feel like you might want to give the monkey butt so that you have the monkey tail, which would add
they
like
had
a
the
whole
monkey
different...
Tail. Oh, they had a, it had a monkey tail,
okay.
Which was also interesting. Yeah, it was unclear where the monkey tail was coming up, but they did have a monkey tail.
I see. So that that does raise the question of where the torso begins, actually. Like, maybe it's just baby legs, but it did have the baby diaper. But you could put a baby diaper on a monkey torso. We'll never know what's under that diaper, Seth. Thank God.
We don't want it. You don't want to know what's under that diaper. The other, the big sort of maybe the most, perhaps the most controversial ad of the night was the Doritos ad where the fetus is seen on ultrasound reaching for a Dorito. There's like the clueless dad is eating Doritos during the ultrasound. And as he holds a Dorito near the woman's stomach, the fetus pictured on the ultrasound reaches for the Dorito. And then somebody throws the Doritos back to the other side of the room and the baby ejects itself. We don't see it, but it's sort of implied the baby has ejected itself from the womb in quest of the Doritos on the other side of the room. Okay. And so Nayral tweeted that this was an instance of humanizing fetuses and thus expressed its disapproval. How did you guys feel about the Dorito ultrasound fetus ad?
I felt offended by its stupidity, but not really by its reproductive politics. In part, this is like splitting hairs, but the baby, like that was a very far along fetus. If that makes sense.
If he can, in fact, reach.
That was like definitely a post-20 week fetus.
That's actually diagnostic of the baby being ready to be born. Oh, he's reaching for Doritos. It's fine. He can survive outside the womb.
It really seemed like a third trimester fetus. Yeah. So anyway, I mean, I don't know. It was dumb. I feel like they were trying to live wire it in a way that the other ads weren't. Like, I think you're right that this was a very conservative group of ads that was trying not to offend. It was not trying not to offend people by being overly pompous and somber. It was trying not to offend people by putting any kind of cheesecake up, which I think is an advantage. One trademark here would be the Axe ad, which we should listen to for a minute.
Come on, a six-pack? Who needs a six-pack when you got the nose? Or a nose when you got the suit? Now you don't need a suit when you got the moves. Or moves when you got the fire. Or fire when you rock those heels. And heels when you ride those wheels. Looks, man, who needs looks when you got the books? Or books when you got some balls? And who needs all that when you get the door?
I mean, the notion that Axe Body Spray, which has been one of the biggest offenders over the last 5 or 10 years of like, look, nerdy pimple man, like spray this on your body and like like babes of untold lusciousness will just fall from the sky like a blizzard. You know, like was suddenly about like owning your big nose and like being like an awesome like gay b-boy. Like, go Axe, that's great.
And dancing in heels.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, that was, yeah, that was
like
that was
the gender bending Axe head. I loved that. And so it felt like Doritos was just working in a different mode here, where it's like instead of trying to not to entertain without offending, it was like, let's just push some buttons. Let's go for the you know, kind of reproductive politics live wire. And honestly, who's the Doritos consumer? Is it someone who's going to be offended on either side of the abortion debate? Like, not really. Like, people who eat Doritos just want Doritos. They're not, like, the world's greatest thinkers.
Wow. Wow, Julia. A slur against millions of Americans.
Are you all right?
We just lost a huge percentage of our listenership.
First of all, I eat Doritos.
People who eat Doritos couldn't possibly have an opinion on one of the larger social issues of our time. QED.
It's all about crunch, crunch, crunch for them.
I just had trouble getting exercised about that ad. I don't know. Am I wrong? Is this like a dreadful... I mean, you're right. Abortion is under assault. I should be very offended. Are you guys offended? Tell me I'm stupid and I should be offended.
I think it lays the basis for a new constitutional theory of fetal viability. I mean, the ability to reach for a salty snack.
Actually, if that's the theory of viability, that works very much in Nayral's favor.
Wait, what if yes, that kid exactly. came out, that premature Dorito-reaching infant, and it was the puppy monkey baby?
It's full circle.
Seth, is this a fluke year, or is the Super Bowl ad over as a form?
I think you could make the argument in both ways. This certainly seemed like evidence that the Super Bowl ad as a form is over. And this has been an increasing trend. There have been fewer and fewer epic, large-scale ads that really felt like Super Bowl ads. People introducing some huge new product or thing. That hasn't been happening the last couple of years. But you could argue that, you know, the fracture of audiences, at some point it will come full circle. Like, I would point to that Persil ad again, which I know it amuses you how bottom line I am about this, but it is still the place where you reach all demographics all at once, and it still is effective for that, and there are vanishingly few ways to do that. So I think it still has a place for certain advertisers, but it may be that the the brands or context in which it makes sense is definitely narrowing.
I will say that the Persil ad itself did not make me want to try Persil, but your repeated discussions of the Persil ad has raised my Persil awareness, and I'm actually going to try Persil.
Well, I own a couple of distributorships of Persil.
You're Peyton Manning-ing us. Damn it.
All right. Well, Seth, thank you so much for coming back on the show. It's always just a total delight.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Seth Stevenson's piece on the best Super Bowl ads will be, we'll link to it on our show page, but you can find it at slate.com. All right. Well, Seth, will you stick around and endorse with us?
I will.
Lovely. All right. Now is the moment in our program where we endorse. Dana Stevens, what do you got?
This week, I am going to endorse a piece of software. And first, I should shout out that it is fellow podcaster Tanner Colby, who does the About Race podcast and who has done many a podcast with me in the past, that recommended this piece of software to me. It's called Scrivener. And I asked before we started taping, Steve, if you wrote your just finished book using this piece of software. And you said no, right?
I didn't, though midway through someone told me it was the way to go, and I'm certainly going to be checking it out. But
yeah,
I
feel like I'm so glad that I listened and discovered it. I mean, I guess I downloaded this as soon as Tanner raved to me about it and said, you know, he's written all of his books using it. But learning a new, fairly complicated software program when you've already got good old Word that you've been typing away in for decades was somewhat of a low priority task. But once I started getting enough material, enough kind of scattered Word files that I needed some sort of order to put them in, I finally sat down, watched some tutorials, and started using this very powerful piece of software, Scrivener. And I highly recommend it to anybody who's working on not just a book, but any kind of project involving notes, research. I mean, it could be great for, you know, a academic paper or even a journalistic, you know, if you had like a long form piece you were working on. Because what it does, how do you describe what it does? I mean, it essentially creates a very flexible structure for a lengthy text that you can plug in and import files from in any way you want. So, you know, as you're sitting there typing away, composing as if in Word, you can do things like import PDFs into your research, you know, create footnotes and save them for the future, add images and save them in a place where they'll come popping back when you need them. I haven't yet figured out all the powerful things that this program can do, because it seems like even if you just use 10% of them, it's a big boon for writers. But yeah, I recommend Scrivener very highly. It is not free. It's a fairly expensive piece of software, given that, you know, you can get so many good things for free, but I think it's really worth the investment. So Scrivener, mm-hmm. You can find it at a site called literatureandlatte.com.
Mm-hmm. Lovely. All right. And Julia Turner, what do you have?
Oh, well, this is an oldie but goodie, but I have not consumed any culture I've truly adored this week beyond Beyonce's Formation video. So I will just re-recommend something I've recommended in the past, which is Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk by Ben Fountain. And it's this just tour de force of a book. It's set entirely on one day at one football game. It's a Dallas Cowboys game, and it's in the early aughts during the Iraq War, and a group of soldiers who've just accomplished some mysterious but lauded feat in Iraq are home on like a 10-day leave, trying to sell the rights to their story to Hollywood and doing a kind of like showcase at the halftime show of this big televised football game along with Destiny's Child. So there's a lot in the book literally about Beyonce as a halftime performer at a football game. And that is one of the very many pleasures that the book offers. It remains one of my best reads of the last 5 years. So if you didn't listen to me last time, what's wrong with you? Go read it now.
So good. It also has a thinly veiled Jerry Jones character, the owner of the Dallas Cowboys, who's quite well done.
Yeah, the whole thing is great. And actually, I think Ang Lee is making a movie of it soon.
Those fictional characters got their movie made after all.
Yes, I'm excited about that. So again, that's Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, a title that seems unwieldy until you fall in love with the book, and then it seems mellifluous and perfect. Read it.
That sounds terrific. Seth, what do you got?
The only culture I've been consuming recently began when I was on a sailboat on vacation, which was delightful, and I started reading the Aubrey Maturin series, which are Patrick O'Brien's books. You may know them as the Master and Commander series. They're in the British Navy, the Royal Navy, and it's a couple of characters aboard boats fighting the French. It sounds all very naval, and I will admit that I enjoy the references to mizzenmast, topgallants, and other naval fare, but they're just wonderful historical novels. So they were written between 1969 and 1999 by Patrick O'Brien. There are 20 of them. There was a 21st one unfinished when O'Brien died in 2000. And they're just so delightful. The two characters are so perfectly drawn, and their relationship is so perfectly drawn, and the humor is so dry. They made one movie of this with Russell Crowe, who's actually perfectly cast, and Paul Bettany. So it's the Captain Jack Aubrey, who is this, you know, full of life, sea captain, heart of gold, and then his partner, the doctor, Stephen Maturin, who is the more intellectual, slightly darker soul, and they ride ships together. They have string duets, and they talk about life. And when they're at peace, they're on land, and it just suddenly turns into a Jane Austen novel, which, as you may know, I also love. So imagine a Jane Austen novel, but at sea with lots of naval references. You could not. It's like the Puppy Monkey Baby of books for me. You could not make a better book than to combine Jane Austen and nautical fare. So the Master of the Aubrey Maturin series by Patrick O'Brien, I will recommend. I would recommend to all, not just people who want to read about Mizzen Masts.
I have never read any of those. I will confess that I have them classified in my mental library of books I haven't read as dad books. But you're saying that's
maybe a fair criticism.
It's fair, but it's a dad book worth reading.
But Julie, I know your love for Jane Austen novels, and I'm telling you, the romances here and the language and the delightful characters, Regency era characters, are right up your alley.
All right, I'm adding it on the list. Do you start at the beginning? I think it's hard also with a 20 book series. Like, should I just read? Is Master and Commander the first one?
Start at the beginning. I'm already pre-sad about reaching the end of the series, even though I'm only just starting book three. I'm already I can already picture the moment when I put down on the unfinished 21st volume in tears, and like I'm locked into this.
You are such
in 2024. All right, I will add it to my list.
A pre-saddened Seth Stevenson endorses Master and Commander. I've never read them either. I'm psyched to. All right. Well, for my endorsement, it's like an old friend, you know, popping up in your social media feed. A band I used to listen to back in the 90s called Freakwater. They're an alt-country band from Louisville, Kentucky. Has either reformed or just reappeared after years off of the scene to make a new record. And what I've heard so far is terrific. I love these guys. I used to listen to them addictively. Their return is just a total pleasure. So check them out. And then the other thing is, has anyone ever heard of Unit 1, the Danish TV series? Whiff. Okay, nothing.
I feel like Plotz just endorse it?
No, he endorsed something Norwegian.
My mistake.
I believe these are the people who went on to make either The Killing or The Bridge. I'm going to say they went on to make the Danish TV show The Bridge. But first they started, what I love about the show is that it combines some elements of the long form binge watch with many elements of the Law and Order rerun, you know, kind of standalone episodic TV where, you know, a story is told in the course of 1 hour. There's a totally predictable rhythm to how the drama is going to unfold, the kind of comfort watch of Law and Order with the, you know, depth and novelistic, you know, portrayals of binge watch TV. And it's from the early aughts. It's really fun. My sense is that season one holds up really beautifully and season two starts strong and maybe gets a little weak. I think there may be four seasons, 30, 35 episodes all in all. I haven't gotten that much further than midway through season two. But anyway, dig it. Check it out. Curious to know if anyone likes it. All right. Dana, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Julia, thank you. It's great to be back.
It's so fun to have you back, Steve.
Yeah, wonderful. Seth, as always, total pleasure. And Tom Brady sucks.
Go Jets.
All right. You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page, slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com or drop us a note at our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Our producer is Ann Hepperman. Our intern is Lindsay Albrecht. The executive producer of Slate Podcasts is Steve Lichtai. And Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network. All hail the chief. And the Culture Gap Fest is part of the Panoply Network, of course. Check out our entire roster on itunes.com/panoply. Our Twitter feed is @SlateCultFest. For Julia Turner and Dana Stevens and Wesley Morris and Seth Stevenson, I'm Stephen Metcalf. I'm so psyched to be back, and I will see you next week without fail.
Bitch, I'm back. I'm popular, the man.